baby, spread them in that hog. Welcome to the 41st Annual Atlanta Old Timers Meeting. Just for fun, would everybody that's got 41 years or more stand up? Impressive. I wanted to really thank NABBA for being here to support us one more time. Deb downstairs that did a great job with breakfast. Sometime prior to 1982, it was the desire of Paul Chapelier and George Montgomery that some of the old timers get together for fun and fellowship. The event would be held on an annual basis, later featuring a respected AA speaker. This was in 94. You're the respected AA speaker this year, which was great. I got to talk to him last night at dinner. He grew up in NABBA, started off with. For those of you unfamiliar with Atlanta's rich AA history, the Downtown Club was the home of Atlanta's first Alcoholics Anonymous group, dating back to the early 1940s. Gary Nygert will talk more about the history of AA in Atlanta later in the program. First Old Timers Meeting was held here at the NABBA Club in 1982. Since then, this meeting has been an annual meeting held the first Sunday in November here at NABBA. The original tent, and still is, that all meeting participants and the steering committee members have a minimum of 20 years sobriety. That being said, our meetings are open to everyone, and we're glad that you're all here today.
Y'all are a good-looking bunch. You know what they told me when I got here? I said, how do you get to be an old-timer? They said, don't drink and don't die. I've managed to do both. Seriously, this is something I like doing. I've been getting speakers for a couple of decades, not here just the old-timers, just the last 5 or 6 years with that, but for a couple of the state conventions. And it's always a pleasure to go through the process of choosing because you get to hear so many good stories along the way. And they always help me. I'm very grateful. And the one we got this year happens to be an old friend. I got him to come over from South Carolina to speak at my 20th birthday. And I had him back when I celebrated 40 years. He came back again. He wanted to see if I was still doing it right. I said, when I get to be 60, I'm going to invite you back. Okay? But seriously, Neil is someone that I know has a good program because I've been to a lot of meetings with him. And there's a few people in here that have known him for longer than I have. I've known him for over 40 years. So with that being said, I give you Neil B. from South Carolina. Greenville, South Carolina. I've got him.
Well, my name's Neil, and I'll call it. I'm nervous. I know you're not supposed to be nervous when you got 53 years, but so I'm excited. Maybe I'll put it that way. And it's really kind of for a deep reason. And coming down here, for some reason, it took on that meaning of like a high school reunion to me. And I don't know what, you know, and how you think about a high school reunion or something. Now, footnote, I've never been invited to a high school reunion, but, you know, I've heard about them. And I went to them with various spouses, but I don't know. It's just reopened so much of my experience in this fellowship and the people and how important the people are and how important this fellowship is and how important the community is we've got and how I think it's like a depth of gratitude I haven't felt in a long time. And I don't mean I'm an ungrateful person. I'm grateful. I'm very grateful. But to kind of relive and hear names I hadn't heard in a long time and think of conversations I had with people 50 years ago and laughing about them and remembering things. And it's just, I used to be so jealous of people that could get up and rattle off all these great memories they had. I remember we went through a spell, this was in South Carolina, but a bunch of high schoolers, they'd been to high school together, and they'd been to college, and then now 10 years later, and they're coming into recovery. And they all had these stories about high school and stuff like that, and I just said, boy, I wish I had some of those stories, or somebody I knew would get sober, you know. But this happened. And I have great memories, and I have good friends, and I have experiences that they talked about, those fun times in high school. I've had some fun times in recovery, man. I mean, and I think this experience, this specific experience about making me really think about those first few years of my recovery, just opened up a treasure chest of stuff I hadn't thought about in a long time. So, for example, this room really was where the We've Had Enough Young People's Group met when it first started. And the Young People's Group was my saving grace when I came in. And I'll get into that. But so that was over there, you know, 53 years ago. And the month of October, actually, when I came back, October 10th. I also met my first clean, sober, love of my life, you know, God's will and all that good stuff, and married that person. I also met the second person that I married initially in these meetings over here, this building, this room, you know. And so that brought back some memories for sure, but good ones, not bad ones, good ones. In fact, I give all the credit in the world to this program of giving me a way of life that I can kind of talk about shutting the door on the past, you know, not shutting the door on the past, but not living in the past, you know, remembering the good things or remembering the bad things, but just remembering it in a perspective that it can be useful or not paralyzing today. It's not a resentment or it's not a, I regret this I didn't do or this I should do. It's just accepting, you know, what it is. And so, so I'm accepting my journey, you know. And I know it's my responsibility, I think, to share with you my journey, my experience, strength, and hope. Not my opinions, not my, but what the path I walked, and why I'm still here, I think. And maybe more importantly than anything was how I had a spiritual awakening, really. And because I think that's what it, I bought into the idea that that's what it's going to take to stay in this program. That's what it's going to take to keep this way of life. And that is some kind of spiritual awakening, some kind of a acknowledgement that there's a power greater than me that loves me and cares about me and wants to see good in my life, you know. And so I'll start at the beginning, I guess. I was born here in Atlanta in 1949 at, what was it, some hospital downtown. but anyhow, I grew up here. My father was a successful businessman that had a severe drinking problem. And, you know, my mother was a classic, in what I understand about an Al-Anon now, you know. She tried to protect those kids from him. And so one thing I developed early in my life was this kind of self-sufficient, you know. I'm self-sufficient. You know, I mean, I make my own decisions. I take care of myself. And that really became a real distrust of people, you know, when I did that. Now, did I make the wisest decisions when I was 12 years old? Or, you know, seemed like the right thing to do at the time, usually, but no, in hindsight, it wasn't. I grew up in a nice neighborhood. You know, we were, you know, 2.5 kids in a fence family, you know, and over on Lake Forest Drive, Chastain Park, you know, and walked through the swimming pool when I was a kid, and across the golf course, and you know, just idyllic things, but at home it was different. And my father was, I just never knew who he was. You know, he would be intoxicated and, you know, he'd isolate or he would come in and want to tell us stories and, or he would come in mad as hell about we didn't know what. But it started developing that thing in me about self-preservation, I guess you might say, not the natural instinct to just, you know, I knew I gotta, this ain't gonna happen because I developed a big trust in him because of all these promises he would make and, you know, it never came to pass. I kind of know today half of them probably didn't come to pass because he didn't remember making them, you know. We had moved from there out to Sandy Springs and, I was in, I guess, seventh grade or whatever that is, but we went out there and he was, I think my father was trying to make a new start, and that's another part of my story, but we went out there and, you know, it wouldn't take long, we were back to square one, and so I my first in spirit in high school, I wasn't an anti, you know, I'm never going to drink and be like him. I didn't have that, but I wasn't going to act like him. I know that, you know. But first time I ever drank alcohol was in October, ironically enough, Halloween area, and I drank a bunch of vodka, and I blacked out, and I made a complete ass out of myself, I thought. I woke up in my front yard missing my shirt, and went back to the house, and, you know, say, oh, my God, what happened, you know, and so went to school the next day, and I was kind of, you know, what did I do, you know, and so I got this hero's welcome. Oh, man, you're crazy, you know, and so my behavior, and so I think I adopted that identity right away. it felt like it did, so, and it started off slowly, and it went downhill from there, you know, and I was a blackout drinker. Blacking out was just part of my experience. And at 15 years old, I was waking up in Florida with my mother's car wondering, how the hell did I get here, you know? And it wasn't good. I started getting more trouble, and I started becoming more unpredictable. I would be, classic Jekyll Hyde. I mean, I would be, you know, funny and ha-ha, some, you know, lampshade kind of drunk, you know, and then I'd be violent, and I'd hit you over the head from the back with a bottle. I don't know why, just do it, you know. And so, needless to say, my popularity kind of fell off the curve because I was so unpredictable. And of course, all of this started rolling together to form what I think was my value system, my whatever you want to call it, way of life. But that thinking and that way of dealing with life and other people that I believe today is wrapped up in my disease of addiction. It really is. I mean, the alcoholic thinking and all those things I've learned about, they were all happening. It was all like a train ready, you know, heading for the tunnel. And so anyhow, I started getting in trouble. I started getting locked up. I started going to juvenile. I stayed juvenile. They're merciless at juvenile. They shaved your head when they took you in, and then they kept you overnight and sent you home. You know, so damn, gotta stay a couple other days. but anyhow, that just didn't get better from there. At school, I stopped attending. I'd get my books at the beginning of the year. I'd put them in a locker. I'd lock the locker, and that's it, you know. And that was school. And going to school was where I went to kind of find out what was going on. You know, where was the party this weekend or something? And I realized that, you know, my thinking had just become so centered in that. And I didn't realize this at the time, but that's all I thought about. I've never had a date, never been to a dance, never been to a football game, unless I was under the influence. And then I probably couldn't remember being there. You know, I just got used to that. And so anyhow, I had a couple of incidents happen, and I've had DUIs now, and I was out of school, and I was sleeping all day and staying out all night, and other drugs had become a part of my experience too, and just, you know, life was not going good. And so I went in front of the judge for another time in Fulton County, another DUI. And I like to think back that the state-of-the-art treatment at that time was real simple. This was in 1968 or 9. You could either go to jail, you know, go to prison, or you could join the Army and go to Vietnam. So I did that, and I joined. I took a lot of other people there were the same consequences. You know, it was like now they send you to meetings, you know, lawyers. Now lawyers then would say, join the Army. So I did, and that's another chapter story in my life. Now, and this is kind of a good news, bad news thing, again, in hindsight, the Army was the first place I'd ever had to be accountable to somebody, you know, kind of. I just never been, and I was a good complier, you know. If I needed to say yes, I'd say yes. If I needed to say no, I'd say no. But whatever the circumstance, I was going to do what I was going to do, and that was it, you know. And I just thought that's the way you did it. That wasn't like some insidious, malicious thing. It was just, you got to take care of yourself. You know, got to watch out for yourself. And so I went in there and learned, you know, something about teamwork and something about different things. But if again, at the time, it didn't make any sense. In hindsight, it might have saved my life, you know, in many ways. Went in. My father's strength had taken a real bad turn, and he was the day I was graduating from basic training in Columbus, Georgia, was contacted and told I was needed at home because my father had taken he was hospitalized and taken a turn for the worst and all this. So they canceled my orders for advanced infantry training, and I went home. And I got on a bus with a guy in Columbus, Georgia, and rode home, and we split a fifth of liquor. And when I got home, I went out on the strip downtown when that was happening, and in uniform, and you know, partied for about 2 days, and then went home. And then I went and saw my father. And I went and saw my father with people waiting on me in a car in the parking lot. And I literally, you know, I went in, how you doing? You know, and he was not doing good, obviously. And yeah, well, and it was like, hey, I gotta go, see you, love you, and that I went. Got in the car, I went to Lake Lanier, called the Army and told them how desperately I was needed at home, and then I partied 3 more days and then went back, you know. During that trip, what became my first wife, we were on those parties up in Lake Lanier, and she called me and told me she was pregnant. That was right after. When I got back to Fort Benning, I was contacted that he had taken a turn for the worse now and really probably going to die. And so they want to come back. I went back, and I did the same thing. I got messed up going up there. It took me 3 days to get home. I made it to his funeral from a phone booth on Roswell Road calling my mother. And that funeral was that morning. I went. Got with all some family members from Louisiana, and they're all drinkers. And we sat around traffic. Cul-de-sac from the neighborhood and drank, passed around liquor. Just crazy. Just crazy. And the reason I say that is because, I don't know, I didn't get it for a long time. If you asked me what the problem was the alcohol, you know? The problem was the alcohol. And so I remember somebody saying, if the problem was just the alcohol, if it was just the alcohol, then hell, you just stop drinking and live happily ever after. When I came home. I was at home for a while, and then I left and went to Vietnam in like April, she had the baby. Okay, fine. Thank you, Father. But, yeah. 53 years, I thought it had been. So anyhow, went back. But those things like that experience with my father and what the visitation I didn't do and all that, those started weighing on me about what a bad person I really was. I wasn't just a bad person comparing me to somebody else. I was really something wrong with me, you know, and I really bought into that, and I was right, but that self-image really started going down the drain. And when I got to Vietnam, got over there, I was with the 25th Infantry Division, I drove trucks, but I'd always dabbled in, you know, extracurricular alcohol and other drugs, and when I got over there, I dabbled with a lot, you know, and got really involved with meth for a while and other things, but alcohol was always my downfall, really, in a way. Other drugs, my performance was kind of predictable, you know. I wasn't that maniac, and alcohol, it was all odds on. Nobody, no telling what was going to happen. I mean, I could not guarantee you anything if I had a drink, and so I was starting to substitute drugs for alcohol, you know, and crazy. But when I got back, I came back, I was wide open, and I come back from to a wife that now I had a 10-month-old child, and in my brain, I was not happy with myself over there, and I always hold on to that thing about it's going to be better on the other side. So when I get back in Atlanta, now I'm going to be a father, and I'm going to be a husband, and you know, all that good stuff. And Oh, the other list was when I went in the Army. I was going to get my high school diploma, and I was going to have college paid for when I turned out, and I was going to become a brain surgeon, and, just great plans, but I didn't have the high school diploma when I came out, and that other vision of what was going to be like when I got home, it wasn't that. You know, I was in jail about 3 days after I got home. At that time, you could kind of ride that Vietnam vet thing. They'd give you a little break, you know. You get a DUI, and he's readjusting. That's it. But anyhow, that didn't work. But meanwhile, that self thing was just going spiraling down and down and down. And that, so we're at that point where I remember somebody talking about when the drinking became pathological, like, and, you know, I was drinking by myself, I was holding up places, I was, you know, like drinking just until I got deathly ill, just not good. So, what had happened? My mother-in-law, when I was overseas, decided she had a problem with alcohol, and she went to this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. When I got home and started getting in trouble right away as a direct result of my drinking, she started, you know, hey, you ought to come to a meeting with me. And I said, yeah, right, you know. Again, preconceived ideas about what that must be like. Gosh, can you imagine? But she'd leave those damn folders or flyers of the literature around, you know, that 44 questions was a good one. Remember the one I was actually lied on. I said, have you ever been hospitalized? No, I have never been hospitalized for my drinking, unless you count being stabbed in the neck, literally, being hospitalized for my drinking, unless you provide convulsions, serious convulsions, and alcohol withdrawal, and being alcohol toxic before, like, holy shit, the doctor couldn't believe I was still alive at 19 years old, and the content. And so, you know, I got honest about that. So anyhow, long story short, I say I don't have but 2 hours left, so. I went to my first meeting at the disc game room in Atlanta on a Sunday night, and I went in the room, I was 21, the lag days, there was a big gap from age difference. There was a few younger people there, but I just, you know, went in with a, I'm not one of these people, I don't want to be one of these people, and how can they live a life like this when you could be having so much fun, you know? What am I going to give up if I do this? Well, what I was giving up at the time was standing in the house doing like that, thinking people were pumping shotguns outside my door. That was a good time, you know, and my brain, for some reason, I'm giving that up, you gotta be crazy, you know. That way, this boring way of life you guys got. So anyhow, I went in. I didn't identify, but I could not deny a feeling I got in that room. There's just something that I felt in that room, and I don't know, maybe some of you identify, maybe some don't, there was just something that I was missing that I felt in that room that night. So I kept coming back for 89 days, and it made my mother-in-law happy, and it made my wife happy, and then I decided, I'm just going to smoke dope, because what's wrong with that? Well, it may not be wrong for anybody else, but this alcoholic, it was wrong. Because about 2 joints into it, I was already in beer, and then my drinking took off again, and I was in trouble again. And so 9 months later, I made it back to the Biscayne in October, and I've been there ever since, you know, in the program of recovery. I think about the people when I came in, and I guess that's what I was talking about earlier about when I came in to Biscayne. It was at 1224 Dresden Drive, right by the railroad tracks. And I noticed a funny little footnote when I used to travel a lot. when I go to another town, they'd say they have a meeting at a clubhouse somewhere, and I'd go to the meeting, and I'd be damned if there wasn't a railroad track there. Every meeting I went to, like, railroad track in the clubhouse. That must be a requirement for a clubhouse. But anyhow, so I went there, and somebody stayed with me for 3 days. My wife and I were separated and ultimately divorced, and that was not a good one. And it was just a hard time, but an exciting time. You know, exciting in the fact that I thought I'd found something, and I did. And all I needed to do was follow directions. Now, I'm trying to tell you about why I think I had a spiritual experience and what are some of the things about the steps that happened for me. So I came back. I got involved. I'm very, very grateful that I started at the Biscayne Room with Maggie and Billy Dee and all those people. The Atlanta Biscayne Room in 1970, I think since 1960-something, but had the answering service for the greater Atlanta area from like 6 o'clock Sunday, I mean Friday till 6 o'clock Sunday. That's all of Atlanta. If anybody was calling for help to the line, it came through there. I went to an answering service, and just to put a date on it, to give some idea, I think the answering service was segregated at that time when I came in. And the answering service person would kind of determine where somebody was calling from or something, you know, and so they'd have a list of names, you know, to call and follow up, and that was the way it was. And I started going on 12-step calls, in 30 days. I was driving a car for somebody, you know, and that's an experience I think is one of the cornerstones of why I'm still here. And that's also one of the things that changed since I've been here. And it's one of those things, it's kind of the good news, bad news thing, because I experienced it. When Teachers Hospital opened, for example, it was one of the state-of-the-art kind of treatment centers, and there was big public awareness about alcoholism, and treatment was good, and most of the treatment centers took that Hazelton, and I'm not here trying to promote anything, I'm just saying it's personal experience with this. And this was like that, and, you know, so it was a good deal, and it was. And the question when the answering service phone rang started changing to like, okay, man, where do you live? Where can I get you? Where can I get you to take you to a meeting or bring you to the Biscayne? And do you have insurance? And it's like, suddenly it kind of changed. Because I was like excited, man, you got insurance. You could get detox. You could get, you know, because detox at the Biscayne was kind of rough sometimes. Here's a trash can, you know, with a liner in it, and this is your, I can't remember what they called it, but if you took the responsibility of somebody being there, you had to commit for 3 days to taking care of them. And taking care of them was making sure they had cigarettes and making sure they ate. That's taking care of them. So, different time. But, and if somebody though got real sick and had burned their bridges with the hospitals, actually, I mean, they couldn't get in an emergency room or anything. And, there were, a certain doctor, I'll break his anonymity. He ain't here now, but Conway, a lot of people knew, went on to the treatment field, but he was a gynecologist in Atlanta, and if you had a serious problem with somebody, he would come. He'd make a house call, you know, with the Biscayne. And I believe he saved some people's lives. I really do. And he also got some people in the emergency room that needed to be in the emergency room that we couldn't. And so that's just one of the little nuances of the trail I travel. And so now, carrying the message, I kind of had to reconcile to it's different. It's not talking to somebody that's never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. They can quote you the big book. They've been through it 5 times in treatment and given the steps and all that. So it's a little different thing, you know, for me it is. And but it always just kind of comes full circle back to the basic principles of this spiritual, not religious program, you know. This is the way we do it. This is the 12 steps. This is the way we do it. And now there's a whole lot of other options, and I'm grateful there were so many options. And this is the way we do it, and I hope and pray that that's the way we stay doing it, and I think it will be, because people are still getting better, you know, still finding a way out. See, most of the people I knew had tried all that other stuff, you know, they tried that, and it wasn't working, so this worked. So anyhow, I got that thing about service early on, and so I've been involved in service in one form or the other since my beginnings. I still go to H&I, I do PR stuff, I do, chair my home group, but, I think it's important to me to do that, and it keeps me in touch. I don't know why I got all that, but anyhow, I have a whole bunch of rabbit holes I've realized since last night and this morning talking to people. It just triggers something. But I did want to share about my experience with the 12 steps because the first time I came around, I really didn't buy into the fact that I needed any of this like you guys did. But, I was kind of picking and choosing what I was going to do. And I liked the fellowship, and I loved the humor in recovery. There was a lot of funny people and, funny stories. And that kept me coming back. But when I hit that crossroads of where I had this overwhelming desire to, like, man, I just want to. And they talk about that time where you have no effective mental defense. Well, I think I used to think I'd reached that a lot of times, but I don't think really in hindsight, I wanted, I saw something, made me think about drinking, boy, I'd like to try one of those or something. But that time, I'm talking about that feeling of powerlessness, oh my God, I'm going to do it and I don't want to do it. And literally scared. And then turning to the tools that I've been given, like calling somebody or talking to somebody. So the steps were kind of slow, but the first step when I came in was sat down, and Billy B became my first sponsor. About the first step, it's like, what don't you get about the first step? that was the question. That I'm powerless over alcohol, my life become a manager. What don't you get about that? I'm powerless, and it's unmanageable for sure. I really couldn't say it the first time I came around. I said, I'm powerless over that, but it's not unmanageable. I can handle it, but I didn't. Then I moved on to the second step, and the second step I got hung up because when I would go to a meeting about the second step, they would be talking about God if they understood God, and I got real intimidated by that. I thought being the values I said I had when I got here, they were really, one of my biggest cornerstone defects of mine was that it wasn't important what I thought of you or what you thought of me. It's what I thought you thought of me. That's what was important. Still is today sometimes, but that's what managed it. And I was intimidated by not being able to rattle off all this good stuff about a higher power or something. But again, the sponsor sat down and said, where did you say God in here in the second step? And I said, well, it doesn't. He said, he said, you came to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. So see that electrical out there? Why don't you go stick your finger in it and tell me if that's a power greater than you or not? It was just that simple, just that acknowledgement that there was something greater than me, And that's the little door of humility I needed. And then a real true turning point for me, and now I was in the third step, looking for that God of my understanding. And I was at a convention, I think it was a Southeastern convention, Alcoholics Anonymous, in Birmingham, Alabama, and a lady was reading How It Works. And it was a big crowd, and she was just nervous, real nervous, and shaking and deep breath, and like me. She said, on the third step she read it, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as He understood us. And I remember I went, oh, that's messing up my embarrassing. And then it's like something in my brain snapped like that. It says, what's wrong with that? And that was my entrance into developing an effective relationship with the power greater than myself. I didn't have to understand. I didn't have to be able to quote any books. I didn't have to be able to do anything. I just have to, have to acknowledge that there's a power greater than myself, and it's not me, and I'm willing to turn my will and my life over it. I used the groups for a while, you know, like they suggest, you knew more than me, but that fourth step, that third step really knocked down the door for me, because that was the time when I was starting to have that first feeling about I'm going to drink and I don't want to. And so, anyhow, but honest to God, I can go on and on. I'm not. I'm just going to tell you that I really appreciate this opportunity for me. Most of you know me that have known me, and I got real involved in Narcotics Anonymous when they came around, because this young people's group was my saving grace, because people there, there were other Vietnam vets there, there were other people that had problems, not just with alcohol. Alcohol may be in the primary, but all the other drugs that couldn't stay clean and couldn't stop, and substituting one thing for the other. And so this group understood it. It seemed like they understood that it was about total abstinence, you know. And I'm grateful for that. Most of the people in my life were like that. That's me. Now, if California's clean and all this stuff that's new, maybe that's working for you. I've got some friends I've been in recovery a long time that surprised me with the path they're taking and what they're doing, but they seem to be benefiting from it, and that's their business, not my business. I read a thing about, and I said some conversation I was in last night, but it talked about these phases of a relationship, and it was talking, this was a parent-child kind of thing, but it says, you know, the first was idealization, that, you know, you idolize something, and that's what I did with Alcoholics Anonymous. And then there was demonizing it, and which I did with Alcoholics Anonymous one time. What about total abstinence, you know? And then there was humanizing it, which I hope I'm at that point with this. You know, I hope that with, and from last many years have been, that you've got your own path to walk. You know, I got my own path to walk. My business is try to be loving and supportive and help you in any way I can. Because Maggie used to say, you know, I don't necessarily like you, but I love you. And I said, what do you mean by that? She said, well, I don't want to see you drink. And I realized that that's the truth. There's not a person in this room, if I've met you or not met you, that I want to see drink. Because I know the horrors of it. You know the horrors. That's my good wish. That's my love for you. And so I'll try to do what I can to help you, just like they did with me. So I'm truly grateful for that. I guess one thing more than anything else, like I said, is finding that relationship with the power greater than myself. That's been the freeing thing. And I've been through a lot of different hoops and things, and new age and old age, and, you know, eastern, western, you name it, you know. And it's been fun. I like the seat. But I'm real comfortable with a pretty simple explanation. And I can't find anywhere else to the community that supports that is what I find here. And not only here, I can get my car and drive to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and look up the next meeting and go in there and feel kind of that same, I'm not a stranger, you know, I'm home here. And that's amazing. That is amazing. And, you know, now I'm strung out on podcasts, which I don't think is good. And, but I listen to all this different stuff, and all the only thing that keeps rolling through my mind is that, like, well, they should put principles for personalities, or, well, they should, you know, it's amazing how these principles we talk about and these tools we use to live start to permeate other parts of my life. And when I started to practice these principles in all my affairs to the best of my ability, I remember work was one of them, and I was kind of a, there was work and there was this, you know, and when it started to really blend, when I was, I wasn't out trying to hustle you out of anything. I was trying to carry a message of how I might help you, you know? And my experience with work went like that. And my experience with stress from work went like that, you know? And so it's a way of life that works. And if anybody that's new, give it a chance. You got nothing to lose. That's what I was told, and they were right. And I found more than I'd ever dreamed I would find. But not only that, I know it's not over. You know, this journey's still going on, and I'm amazed at things that happen, like, just like this whiskey for me. So, anyway, thank you so much. Yeah.
we have a gift for you. I hope this is put in a place where you remember us. This is handmade.
That is cool. Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gary. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to this afternoon's symposium. I'm sorry, I'm getting carried away. I'm to do Atlanta AA history, and we'll only do a brief highlights. The first AA meeting in Atlanta, which was actually held on October 29, 1940, that's 7.5 months before Atlanta celebrates its anniversary. That's documented by the GSO, incidentally. It was Bill Wilson credited Irwin M. Meyerson of Cleveland, Ohio, a champion salesman, with founding the meeting in Atlanta. But, as it so turns out, by April, the last person that was at that original meeting was doing 60 days in a workhouse. And as a result, he was not able to attend, and there was no meeting after that April of 1941. We have a co-founder, and the co-founder is Reverend Sam Daugherty, who is quite a story all by himself. He was in New York, and he was working too hard. So he was prescribed a milk punch made with a glass of whole milk, an egg, a little sugar, cracked ice, and about 1.5 ounces of whiskey, or rum. Now, you all know what happened. Eventually, there was no milk punch, and there was no egg, and there was no sugar. And there was only booze, and he ended up getting fired, which got him down to Atlanta, and he was a minister here until he got fired from that as well. He was a minister at Westminster Presbyterian Church. He wandered as a nomad, literally, for 8 years before coming back to Atlanta. In September of 1939, Sam's wife brought Alcoholics and God by Morris Markey, but Sam wasn't ready yet. He put an ad in the paper November 28th in 1940 with a rather unusual title, "I Should Be Dead, but I Haven't the Nerve to Kick Off Even Though My Past 40, My Family Must Eat." And so he was vouched for by a columnist, Morgan Blake, who I'm going to be talking about a little bit, and Sam's wife brought the March 1, 1941 Jack Alexander article, the Saturday Evening Post. He finally read it, and that's how he ended up getting sober when a fellow, I don't know whether or not he was a sergeant or an officer, co-founder Steve M. Actually, the genealogy of Atlanta AA is by way of Bill Wilson, Fitz Mayo, Steve Morris, Steve M., and he's the one that brought Atlanta to they brought Alcoholics Anonymous to AA. He was one of the six boys of 39 that is part of Washington, D.C.'s Alcoholics Anonymous. In June 8th of 1941, Steve placed an ad in the Atlanta Constitution, and the title of the article is "Alcoholics Anonymous Moves to Atlanta with a Unique Plan." It was 4 days later that in Buckhead, on June 12th of 1941, that the first AA meeting that stuck. And the three co-founders then are Steve M., Reverend Sam D., and Ernest S. They met in Buckhead's basement of Steve M. A couple of wives were there. The AA group grew under various names. The Downtown Group, the Midtown Group, the Wilson Club of AA, the Atlanta Group. The Wilson Club of AA was one of them, was the only meeting in Atlanta until February of 1946. They met at the 57.5 Street Broad Street Clubhouse. This was in the, this is out of the Atlanta Central Office history. In 1942, AA was beginning to grow. The Robert Fulton Hotel was no longer adequate. We obtained a meeting place at the club room at 57.5 Broad Street. I believe that was financed by member of AA that was part of the Coca-Cola. The last name was Candler. And actually, how times change in many regards, because now we try to stay anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films and so on. But actually, AA was the benefactor of newspaper columnists. particularly there's four that stand out at the Atlanta Journal. One of them was Morgan Blake, who wrote between 1942 and 1949. He ran the largest Sunday school at the Tabernacle downtown in Atlanta. And also, he in 1944 at the Atlanta Federal Prison, he was the mediator that put the prison riot to an end, which ended up getting him a commendation from the President of the United States. And this man, Morgan Blake, though not an alcoholic himself, he got sober in 1923, he wrote 52 articles supporting Alcoholics Anonymous during the 40s. Another fellow, Ernest Rogers, who was a columnist in at the Atlanta Journal from June 46 to September 61, he wrote 17 articles. Then we have, this is a tough name for me to pronounce, Raimundo Diaz, who was Dean of the Cathedral of St. Philip. He was also a WSB radio commentator. He wrote for 6 years, starting in August of 1943, and then another columnist, Pierce Harrison. And these were, again, the total 85 different articles that were written about Alcoholics Anonymous supporting us in the Atlanta area to give AA a legitimate, and they were literally doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Bill Wilson's first visit to Atlanta was documented in the Atlanta Journal of July of 1931, July 31 of 1942, and I've got a picture here, and the headline is Alcoholics Anonymous Chief Visits Atlanta. But they've got a picture of him here. This is before anonymity and so forth. Nice picture. And he goes, under the caption, and it says, doesn't get drunk anymore. Doesn't say he stopped drinking. It just, he doesn't get drunk anymore. Okay? But that's what happens when, you know, we're left to other people that don't know us to interpret what we are. I decided I would include an article that was in May 2nd of 1944, the superintendent of Milledgeville State Hospital for the Insane. We don't call things like that anymore now. But here it was, this was a doctor, and he frankly confessed to an AA meeting in Atlanta that he was ignorant entirely of how anyone in the room ever got sober. And that, I think, is a good marker of where medical science was back then in terms of trying to understand us. A second visit that Bill had in Atlanta was in late May of 1944. This was the Atlanta Journal, and the quote is, members of the Wilson Club of Atlanta are making final plans for the visit Monday and Tuesday of Uncle Bill, founder of the organization. You know, and they have an itinerary for him here with how he actually helped the meeting at the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary. But again, he's referred to as Uncle Bill. And, you know, it's who's sitting in the front row dead center? Mayor Hartsfield. This is a different kind of, it's a different kind of experience. Can you imagine the mayor of Atlanta being here in this day and age? The times have changed. And then I wanted to basically conclude this, though, with a Morgan Blake editorial that was written after Bill left for the second time. But when Bill gets up to speak, the magnetism of the man immediately grips you. He is a grand person, as plain as an old shoe, yet brilliantly educated, forceful in delivery, and he holds you in the hollow of his hand. And the story of his long battle with the dread malady, his many failures to overcome it, and then his victory make up almost as fascinating an adventure as I have ever listened to. Bill's story of how that higher power, how God came to him at that hospital room when he cried aloud for help, is one of the most tremendous stories ever told. Every man and woman in this audience, as they listen to it, experienced a spiritual exaltation in their own lives. It is a great feeling, said Bill, when the dark days come now that I can say, thank God I'm sober. And when the days are bright, I can also say, thank God I'm sober, so I can really enjoy my blessings. And the Morgan Blake concluded that with a message I think that really rings to us all, for the gift. Bill is a great man with a great message. Thank you.
never going back. Only thing I own in a paper sack. I'm all alone, and I'm lonesome day and night. I need someone's hand carry me when I'm tired. I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. On that broad highway.